We are in part three of this series that we're walking through called Iconic. And we are looking at these seven times that Jesus used the statement, I am, to describe who he was, what he was doing, and what all the things were that impacts that were in his life that are impacting our lives still today. And we've talked about the truth is too often our view of Jesus, our view of God, our view of church can easily come from secondhand knowledge, opinions of other people, or we see somebody that calls themselves a Christian acting a certain way, and we go, well, that must be what Jesus was about because that person says they are a Christian. And we actually get to know or judge Jesus from a distance, from secondhand information instead of firsthand experience. And the truth is, even if he walked in the room, we might not even recognize him. It reminded me a few years ago, I was out in California. I was out for a trip with Chase, a friend of ours, that usually plays the drums with us. We were out meeting some people, and he was going to see a specialist, a doctor specialist for tinnitus in his ears at the time. And so I was just sitting out in the lobby, and the doctor, it wasn't a big office. He said, my next patient's coming in a little while. If you hear a knock at the door, do you mind letting them in? And so I said, certainly. A few minutes, a door knocked, a guy walked in, he sits down, and he kind of looked a little familiar, but I was like, he just looks like a guy maybe I know, and back in the city, and then we sit down and start talking. He introduces himself, he says, my name's Chad, I said, my name's Patrick, and we spend, the doctor's appointment went a long time. We spent about an hour and a half just talking to each other, found out he originally was from North Carolina, told him I was originally from Atlanta, living in New York now. He had been in Brooklyn. He's an actor. I started asking him, what's it like auditioning for stuff and not getting it and, just not hitting those roles. I said, that's got to deal with your psyche and your identity. Like all this. We have an hour and a half conversation. Chase walks out. Chase's eyes get about this big, and he's like, Chadwick Boseman, who's the Black Panther, is who I was sitting beside this whole time. And I had no clue that I'm sitting beside like a star from the Avengers, that I'm like, oh my God, I couldn't even recognize this guy. Because the last time I'd seen him on that screen, he of course had all the big stuff on him and everything like that. But I had no clue that I'm sitting beside a guy and I'm asking him like, what's it like to be a failed actor? And he's one of the biggest stars. But these iconic statements, these statements that Jesus gives us are like that. They're gonna help us recognize the work of Jesus. They're going to recognize the person of Jesus in our life and in other people's lives. These icons of bread, light, the shepherd, the door, the way, the vine, and the resurrection are defining qualities of Jesus that perfectly represent who he is. And today's topic that we're going to look at is a descriptor that we don't often hear about when referring to Jesus. When we think about John 10, where we're going to be today, it's usually the statement we focus on is, I am the good shepherd. And we're going to look at that in a few weeks. But what we're going to look at today is what Jesus claims about himself and revealing his character that's actually going to help us understand what it means that he's the good shepherd at a deeper level in a few weeks. And it's found in John 10, verse 7. And he simply says this, truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All right, that's it. That's what we're done for today, right? We all know what that means, right? You hear that, you're like, what is that? As we talked about last week, these are not grand statements Jesus makes when he entered a room or how he announced himself when he walked into the temple. These were statements made about himself in the context of conversation, in the midst of difficult trials, and in moments of confusion or tension or decision. These clarifying statements that communicated who he is as the fulfillment of prophecies as the Messiah. And so let's look at the story behind this statement to better understand what he says. I am the door. I am the door of the sheep. In the two chapters prior to this, we're going to see the story behind this really boils down to about Jesus healing somebody on the Sabbath, pushing back on the religious norms of the time. In the two chapters before, Jesus was pushing back on these religious leaders of the day. He intentionally says and does things that expose their hypocrisy and challenge their belief system. In chapter 8, he actually calls these religious leaders sons of the devil. All right, that did not go over very well, as you can imagine. But he does this not just to poke at them. He does this because he had specific reasons to. They were deluding and distorting the truths of God. They were adding burdens to following the Father that were not originally there. They were using religious systems to control and manipulate people, and they were setting up systems of hierarchy that intended to limit people's access to God. So he called them sons of the devil, because you're certainly not sons of God because you're working against God. They accused him then, if you can believe this, after he calls them sons of the devil, they then accused him of having a demon and even not being Jewish. They basically insulted him in the worst way that they knew how. In verse 48, it said that the Jews answered him, "Are we not right in saying that you are a Samaritan and have a demon?" This was like calling someone insane and questioning every part of their character. It's like when you meet somebody in the city and they go, "You know, you're from New York." "Yeah, I'm from New York." "Well, where do you live?" "Well, I'm in Jersey." "Well, no, it's not the same thing, right? You're not from the city." And that's what they were saying about Jesus. Like, you're saying you're Jewish, but you're acting like something completely different. You're acting like you're from somewhere else, teaching something different, because it was so foreign to them, because they had strayed so far from the actual truth of God. And in the midst of this insult that they gave to Jesus, he again intentionally pokes at their belief system and claimed that he doesn't even have a demon, but instead he was sent directly from God, and claims that those that follow him will never taste death, that they will have a hope beyond their current life and circumstance. And he even goes on to say that he is greater and was even before Abraham, the father of the Jewish people and of faith. And when he says this, they erupt and they pick up stones and try to kill him by throwing stones at him, but he slips away. Jesus does this a number of times in scripture. He like figures out, he slips away. It was a crowded day at the temple. It was a Sabbath. He slips out in the crowd and escapes them into the crowd, which brings us to chapter 9 and what happens immediately before Jesus says, "I am the gate of the sheep. I am the door of the sheep." It says that as he passed by in chapter 9, after he'd escaped, he and his disciples walked by a man who had been known to be blind since birth. Now, this is different than somebody who had went blind. There were instances of healing back then when somebody had gone blind temporarily and then they got their vision back. But it says here, and what we can understand, there had never been a chance of somebody who had been born blind getting sight again. Didn't just happen. Doesn't happen in our world today. And so Jesus sees this man who's blind since birth, and he and his disciples, after some discussion about why he is blind, Jesus does something kind of crazy. He spits in the dirt, makes some mud, rubs it on the guy's eyes, and says, "Now go wash it off and see what happens." And he does. The guy goes, washes, and his sight comes back. And before he could even see who Jesus was, Jesus slipped away again, because he's on the run. While he's on the run, he stops and heals a guy, because he actually knows it's going to do what he's been doing this whole time, poking back at the belief systems of the religious leaders that were keeping people in spiritual chains. And when the leaders hear this story, they don't see it as a sign that Jesus is who he's claiming to be, the Messiah. Instead, they see it as evil again. Because why? Not because he healed somebody, but because of when he did it. He did it on the Sabbath. The Sabbath, a day you aren't supposed to do any kind of work according to Jewish law. The Sabbath had become a day that was filled with extravagant and tedious laws created by the Pharisees to determine when you could and couldn't do on that day. Anything that was considered work was forbidden. There was a limit on the number of steps you could take each day, how much you could carry. It was work trying to figure out how not to work on that day. And Jesus healed, which to them was work, characterized by the Pharisees. So in their minds, Jesus did something good, but in a way that they thought he wasn't supposed to do it. And the Pharisees weren't happy that he had healed on the Sabbath, and they now considered him a sinner again because of it. Yet he was able to heal a man that had been blind since birth, a miracle nobody had ever done before. So they were debating where he got his power from. He couldn't be from God, since he was a sinner, because God wouldn't work through a sinner, so he must be evil. And they couldn't reconcile who Jesus was according to their definition of God, so they got more and more angry at him. Jesus was, again, intentionally exposing them and their hypocrisy. They seek to find Jesus and question him, but they can't find him. So instead, they get the guy that had been healed and bring him in, and they get angry at him that he was even healed, And they end up casting him out of the temple and basically saying, you are lying and your story's not true. And this is where we find Jesus making the next I am statement. So he has had quite a day, quite a run, right? He's been accused of being demon possessed, not even Jewish. He's called the religious leaders sons of devils. He's poked them by healing somebody that nobody else could even think about healing, and he did it on the Sabbath. And he is just punching holes in their religious system all throughout the day, making it kind of difficult for them. And this is, again, where we find him. He sits down, they get to wherever they are hiding, and he sits down with the disciples and his followers and gives them an illustration about who he is and what he is compared to other religious leaders, and now how they've been using God as a tool of manipulation and control, and he is one who wants to give freedom and hope. It's a beautiful illustration that we're going to see here. He's like, I didn't do all that just to get people angry. I did it for a reason, because I want you to see how I'm different. And we're going to see this in John 10, verses 1 through 10. I'll read through this right quick, and then we'll talk about it. Be on the screen. Truly, truly, I say to you, this is Jesus talking. He who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs in another way, that man is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him, the gatekeeper opens, the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he has brought all his own, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, and they know his voice. A stranger they will not follow, but they will flee from him, for they do not know the voice of strangers. And this figure of speech Jesus used to them, but they did not fully understand what he was saying to them. So Jesus again said, truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who come before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep do not listen to them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. The thief only comes to steal, kill, and destroy. I came that you may have life and have it abundantly. Now those listening, even though they may not have gotten the analogy right offhand, would have understood this illustration that he was using. Shepherds were very common in those days. And the visual of shepherds walking around with sheep and putting them into sheepfolds was very common. And there were two types of sheepfolds and pens, and he talks about both of them here. One kind was a public sheepfold found in cities and villages. It would be large enough to hold several flocks of sheep, and the sheep pen would be in the care of a porter or a doorkeeper, whose duty it was to guard the door in the sheep pen during the night and to admit only the shepherds in the morning. And the shepherds would walk into this pen of hundreds of sheep from different pastures that they're not all their sheep, and they would call their sheep. He would use his voice, and only his sheep would follow him out and then follow them out to pasture. And so Jesus, in this example, in the first example, he's saying that as I speak, people know the truth of God. Those who are my true followers will understand truth and will follow it. But then he uses a second one, and the one that he actually says where I'm the door. There was a second kind of sheep pen people understood in those days, and it was in the countryside. There's a picture of it here, not the actual one he was talking about. This is just a leftover one. And it was in the countryside where the shepherds would keep their flocks while they were out in good weather, and they didn't have to come into the city. And this type of sheep pen was nothing more than this rough circle of rocks piled up in a wall with a small opening space to enter. And it was there that the shepherd would drive the sheep at night. And since there was no gate, just an opening, he would literally sleep and stay guard right at that gate to keep out wild animals and others looking to come into the opening. And he would sleep there in case literally becoming the door to the sheep. So when he says, I am the door of the sheep, they would have understood of what he was saying right here. I am the one who is watching guard over the flock, over those that God created, over the people that God is calling to be his followers. And this is what he's saying to them. I am that door. I'm the one who grants entrance to shepherds. I'm the one who keeps thieves away. I'm also the one that literally becomes the door and lays down his life for the sheep to provide security and protection. I'm the door of salvation, redemption, and restoration. Jesus makes sure there's no question about what he's claiming to be here. When he describes anyone would understand that they wouldn't view this door as anything other than the ultimate protector, the ultimate salvation for those sheep. And anyone who tried to come in a door another way was a thief. And if you look at the, put the picture back up there quick, PJ. If you look at this, I want you to see, it's not hard to get in, right? If I was there, I could climb over. What's hard is to get the sheep out. Like, you just can't grab a sheep and, like, jump over, right? So if you get in there and you're trying to do something, get a, just steal a quick sheep, you can't do it. You know what you would have to do? You'd have to hobble the sheep or kill the sheep to get it out. So even if a wolf jumped in, right, he's not going to grab one and run away. He's going to try to make, mess around in the flock, and the shepherd would come in and kill the wolf or run the wolf off. Again, a thief comes in to try to steal. They're not coming in to, like, hey, you're caged up. Let me get you out of here and get you to freedom, right? No, they're coming in to actually steal, kill, and destroy, to bring harm to the sheep. And the shepherd's role is saying, I am there. I am listening. I am the door, the protection. But I think a lot of us, when we see something like this, we see almost more of a cage than we do freedom. And we can often have problems with doors, don't we? I mean, I know when I think about my relationships with doors, it's not that I'm fearful of them or I don't like them or understand their purpose. It's just many times I see them as inconvenient or troublesome. I look at something like that and I was like, oh, it's a cage. You're keeping me in. But I'd rather be out and free. I remember we were, our very first Easter service we ever did when we started New City Church. This was about 9 years ago. We were meeting at a place, it's not even there anymore, well, the building's there, but it was a secret theater. And the secret theater has moved now, but it was up close to Court Square. And we get there, and the guy, whoever's supposed to let us in, was not there. The door was locked. Locked, right? And I got very frustrated, very angry, and I'm like, we're trying to have Easter, we're trying to do something good for God. God, get us into this door. You know, and it's locked. And I think a lot of us, when we think about these doors, we're trying to find ways to either get in or get out. And finally, somebody came and let us in, and we had a first Easter service there, but it was a frustrating day because of an issue we had with a door. And I think a lot of us, when we think about door, can think of it in a few ways. One, sometimes we can view doors as constraining, right? Like locked, separate rooms, keep people out, keep people in. Doors can isolate us from each other and outside circumstances. Only people with a key can choose to let us in, and we can get past that door. Our two puppies that we have now hate it when we close the door, right? We're on one side of the door, and they're on the other. They let us know how angry they are that they are not in there with us. Now, if we have them with us, they actually prefer the door closed so that they know we're not leaving. We're staying in there with them. But we can oftentimes think of doors as constraining, right? We can also think of them as gateways to change. Oftentimes, we don't like change. Going from inside to outside, right? You know, you something familiar to something different. Maybe it's starting a new job, walking through a new door. We think change. I'd just rather stay where I am. We think doors are change. Or we think doors can be concealing, like you hide things behind them. Our house growing up, my mom had a junk room that when people came over, if we had stuff out, it went in the junk room. And that door was closed. And she would say, don't open that door while they're here. Right? Everything else was perfect, but that room, you hid that room and they conceal things. And we kind of do that. Like, even our own hearts, God, if you get into that room, I'm going to keep that hidden from you because there's stuff there I don't even want you to see. We like to conceal things. So we often look at these doors and we're like, they'll constrain me, they'll keep me in or keep me away from something. If I go through this door, it's going to change. It's going to make me do something I don't want to do, or it's going to reveal something that I have hidden. And honestly, a lot of times when we think about Jesus is not just a door, but he is the door, as he's claiming here, of salvation, we start to think of it in these ways. Why is there only one door? What's it going to cost me or change me in my life if I go through that door and follow him? What surprise or shock am I going to find behind that door that I wasn't expecting? Which brings us to the point that I want us to spend the last few minutes on today, looking at a claim that Jesus says that he is the only way of salvation. I am the door, not a door, the door. Think about one of the things that many people have a problem with when it comes to Jesus and Christianity. It's not necessarily his teachings that we say we follow or even the type of lifestyle to adhere to. It is the fact that Jesus claimed, and we believe that he is the only way of salvation. It's a bold claim. And it just seems exclusionary, right? How can there be only one way, one path, one door to God? What about other religions and other belief systems? Are they all wrong? How do we know that Jesus is right? This is actually called the theology of exclusivity. It's a whole study. And we could spend a whole seminary course on this. But the truth is, we must be able to answer this question, right? Because the heart of this question is really about determining the source of salvation. Does it come from God, or does it come from us, from man? When you study world religions, you quickly see a distinction between most world religions and Christianity. Most other world religions put the burden on creating a path to God in the hands of men and women. There are things we must do, paths we must stake, sacrifices we must make. We believe, sometimes some of them believe it takes multiple lifetimes to accomplish this task, and that the job of mankind is to build a bridge to a distant God that's grown angry and disappointed with us, and will only be through our sacrifice and our learning how to be more perfect that we can then finally reach him. Christianity, on the other hand, teaches that there is absolutely nothing man or woman can do to reach God. Our choice to pursue sin does separate us from God, and the chasm is too far, too wide, that no man or woman, no matter how good they are, can bridge that gap. But God can, and God did. He made the path for us. He made the way for us, and that way is Jesus. God in human form, that lived a life of perfection and willingly took on the penalty and shame of our sin, and faced and defeated death, the ultimate price of our sin, and this created a clean, clear pathway to God for restoration, reconciliation, and healing, a way that we were designed to interact with our Creator. And the door to that pathway that God created is Jesus. And this is the claim he's making in these verses. And he is claiming that anyone that tries to create another pathway, a way to sneak into the sheepfold and get to the sheep, is a thief and a liar who is out to harm the sheep more than rescue and protect them. Honestly, I think of it this way. I'm glad that there is actually only one way to God, and that God had provided the way. It makes it simple, clear, understandable. I'm glad that Jesus works to eliminate the pathway of thieves that will put us out to where we're going to have a chance for them to steal, kill, or destroy us. And that's exactly what Jesus is challenging here in these verses. He says the thief, the men who I've just riled up, the ones that are trying to put rules on you, the ones that are manipulating you, controlling a system, setting up hierarchies, those that I just stirred up a hornet's nest with, all those, they're thieves that are trying to steal, kill, and destroy you. But there is one clear way to God. And I'm opening that door. And he brings this up here, right? He says the thief will steal. What will the thief steal? He will steal our peace. Think about this. In John 10, when he says that he comes to steal, he doesn't just steal the sheep, right? He takes them to be his own. And this is what Jesus says those who teach a different way of salvation than the path of God do. When we set up our own way of salvation, it's always based around living up to certain rules, rules that we can't follow. And even when we make them, we can't follow them. And this always leads to guilt. The corrupt path of salvation is works, the idea that we can do good things to offset the bad things we do, and it's this never-ending cycle of guilt, and our peace is broken. The thief will steal your peace by thinking you can do something instead of realizing God has already done everything. The thief then will also kill. And what will he kill? Your purpose. He does this by not caring for the sheep appropriately, right? I told you, when he broke into the sheepfold, he didn't rescue healthy sheep. He would break their legs or kill them to get them out. He isn't a true shepherd because he does not have the sheep interest at heart. And a man-centered approach to salvation will always leave a trail of hurt and destroyed lives. This is because when we set up systems that follow men or women instead of following God, it's going to lead to that. Because you know what? Men make terrible gods, no matter how nice they are. Because we are self-serving and will eventually view people as a way to serve our own interest. So it's going to destroy or kill our purpose, and eventually it's going to destroy our hope. Our hope. And it's this idea that the entire system will eventually break down. And this is what was happening in Jesus' day. The religious system of that day was breaking down, and he was birthing a new one. Think about it. Where there is a system where there is no door, where anyone can come in and out as they please and take whatever they want, will eventually lead to chaos. If everybody can determine the rules, then there are no rules at all, and there's no hope. And I want to be clear. I've honestly experienced this. I've seen it. I've seen spiritual manipulation firsthand. Someone who claims to be a shepherd, but is basically building a flock of their own consumption to feed their ego, to build their own kingdom. They put rules and regulations on others that they don't even live up to themselves. They deceive and manipulate, and ultimately they set themselves up as savior and use Jesus as a distraction to garner their own desires and dreams. And this is what's so damaging about man saying there must be many, many ways to salvation. How can there only be one way? We don't live by this rule in any other aspect of our lives, right? Can you drive any direction you want with no consequence? Can you get on a downtown train and expect you to take it uptown? It's not going to happen, right? There are rules and consequences to rules that we follow. The fact that there is one door, one way, is not limiting at all. It is actually very freeing, simplifying, and clarifying. Think back to that picture, right? There's one way in and out, and if you're in, there's protection and hope, and out, you don't know what's going to happen. And this is what Jesus does. As the door, he restores our peace, right? Christ offers grace instead of guilt, freely offers forgiveness. This worthy path of following him for salvation restores our peace because it takes salvation out of our hands and puts it back in the hands of God. There is peace that comes in our lives when we stop trying to be our own savior. But Jesus then also revives our purpose. He's clear that following him is not about taking up some new set of rules. It's about loving God and loving others. Simple heartbeats that we live by. This is what we're designed to do. Imagine if just our neighborhood, our city, lived with that as their only purpose. Love God, love others. It'd make things a lot simpler, wouldn't it? A lot more joyous to live in. There's simplicity in this purpose. And finally, Jesus rebuilds our hope. When we stop trying to be the source of our own salvation and we can start looking at Christ as the centerpiece of salvation, we can begin to have hope again. I know how broken I am. I know how selfishness lies in my heart. And if I think that it's up to me to restore my hope and restore my relationship to God, I know I'm going to fall short. But through Christ, through embracing the mercy of Christ, that salvation comes to us, not because of our own merit, but because of his great love for us. He gives us an unending source of hope of which to build our lives. And the key idea I want you to grab today is this, is that the right doors provide access and opportunity, right? They're not constraining. They're not concealing. They don't, you know, take us into areas of change we don't want. But the right doors, the door of Christ opens access and opportunity to the fullness of God and the fullness of what God wants for us. This is why he says, I came that you may have life, not just life, but what? Life abundantly, to the fullest, complete, all that you need. This is not a door of limitations, not a path of limitations, it's a path of freedom. Which brings us to the question of the day. What path or what door have you been trying to approach God through? Some man-made gate that's corrupt, like a thief trying to sneak in, or through the worthy gate that Christ has provided? How have you been trying to approach God? What is your view? If you get into that, is your mind thinking, if I get into that pen through that one door, I'm trapped. He's got me. Or do you realize that in that sheepfold, through that one door, the only door, there's beautiful clarity and satisfaction and hope and peace that we won't experience without it? Will you bow your head and close your eyes with me? We have a moment to reflect on this. Just allow that question to float in your mind for a second to say, how have I been approaching God? Thinking that anything can get me to him, any way I come up with or any way somebody else comes up with, or the way that he has shown to connect with him. The beautiful clarity of Christ, the one and only way of salvation. Father, in these moments, let us realize that you are not a God who keeps your distance. You're not a God who creates a maze for us to walk through to try to find you. God, you've created, through Christ, a very clear, compelling, open door of salvation and hope. That through this door, there is a way to you to restore hope, to rebuild purpose, and to find true peace in our life. God, wherever we are in our spiritual journey today, would you allow us to find a way forward with you? For those here that may be seeking or are asking these questions for the very first time, God, allow this idea of the door of the sheep, to realize the freedom we experience and the hope we experience with that. For those of us that have maybe been feeling trapped in this sheepfold of like, what have I gotten myself into? Would you remind us of how much protection and hope is found under your guidance and under your truth? And you are the way. You're the door to true pleasure, peace, meaning, and hope.